great-uncle Silas was a man who never washed himself. "God Almighty," he would say, "why should I? It's a waste of time. I've got someone else to do, so I'd titivate myself with soap." For years, his housekeeper washed him instead. Every morning, winter and summer, he sat in the high-backed chair under the window of geraniums, waiting for that inexorable performance. She would come out at last with a bowl of water and the rank cake of yellow soap that he would say she had been suckled on, and the rough hand flannel that she'd made up from some staunch undergarment she had at last discarded. In winter, the water drawn straight from the well would be as bitter and stinging as ice. She never heated it, and as though her own hands had lost all feeling, she would plunge them straight into it, and then rub the soap against the flannel until it lathered thinly, like snow. Once a week, also, she succeeded in making him take a bath. She gave him that, too. The house was very old, and its facilities for bathing and washing were such that it might have been built expressly for him. There was no bathroom. My Uncle Silas had instead a small iron bath, once painted cream and never repainted after the cream had turned to the colour of earth, which resembled some ancient coracle. And once a week, generally on Fridays and always in the evening, the housekeeper would drag out the bath from among the wine bottles in the cellar and bring it up and get it before the fire in the living room. Very often on fine winter evenings I would walk over to see him, and once, almost forgetting that it was his bath night, I went over on a Friday. When I arrived, the house was oppressively warm with the heat and steam from the copper boiling up the bath water in the little kitchen. I went in, as I always did, without knocking, and came straight upon my Uncle Silas, taking off his trousers, unconcerned, before a great fire of hazel faggots in the living room.
"Oh, it's you," he said. "I thought for a minute it might be a young woman."
"You ought to lock the door," I said.
"God Almighty, I ain't fit at being looked at in me bath."
He held his trousers momentarily suspended, as though in deference to me.
"Never mattered to me since that day when..."
He broke off suddenly as the housekeeper came running in with the first bucket of boiling water for the bath, elbowing us out of the way, the water falling into the bath like a scalding waterfall. No sooner had the great cloud of steam dispersed than she was back again with a second bucket. It seemed hotter than the first.
"Out of my way," she ordered.
"Oh, get us a glass of wine, and don't vapour about so much."
"You'll have no wine till you've been in that bath."
"Then get us a dozen taters to roast and look slippy."
She was already out of the door with the empty bucket.
"Get 'em yourself," she flashed.
"I'm got me trousers off."
"Then put 'em on again."
This relentless exchange of words went on all the time she was bringing the remaining buckets of water in, and he was undoing the tapes of his pants. He shouting for the wine and the potatoes, and she never wavering in her tart refusals to get them. Finally, as he began to roll down his pants and she began to bring in the last buckets of water, he turned to me and said,
"Get a light and go down and fetch a bottle of wine and the taters. Bring a bottle of elderberry, a quart."
While I was down in the cellar, searching with a candle in the musty, wine-odoured corners for the potatoes and bottle, I could hear the faint sounds of argument and splashing water from above. When I reached the living room, Silas was standing up in the bath, stark naked, and the housekeeper was shouting,
"Sit down, man, can't you sit down? How can I bath if you won't sit down?"
"Oh, sit down yourself. I don't want to burn the skin off me behind if you do."
While he protested, she seized his shoulders and tried to force him down into the bath. But his old and rugged body, looking even stronger and more imperishable in its nakedness than ever, was stiff and immovable, and he never budged, except to dance a little as the water stung the tender parts of his feet.
"Get the taters under," he said to me at last. "God Almighty, I shall want summat out of this."
Gradually, as I was putting the potatoes in the ashes under the fire, the arguments quietened a little, and finally my Uncle Silas stooped, half knelt in the water, and then, with a brief mutter of relief, sat down. Almost in silence, the housekeeper lathered the flannel, and then proceeded to wash his body, scrubbing every inch of it fiercely, taking no more notice of his nakedness than if he had been a figure of wood.
"Oh, never could see a damn lot of use in water," he said.
Finally, when she'd washed him all over, she seized the great coarse towel that had been warming on the clothes horse by the fire.
"You're coming out now?"
"Oh, I don't know as I am."
"Did you hear what I said? You're coming out."
"Damn it, you were fast enough getting me in. You can wait a minute. I'm just got settled."
Seizing his shoulders, she began to try to force him to stand up, just as she had tried to force him only a minute or two before to sit down. And as before, he would not budge. He sat there luxuriously, not caring, some of the old devilish look of perversity back in his face, his hands playing with the water.
"He's just doing it on purpose," she said to me at last. "Just because you're here. He wants us to sit here and admire him."
"Oh, don't talk some more. I'm getting out as fast as you'll let me."
"Come on, then, come on. Heaven knows we don't want to look at you all night."
The words seemed to remind my Uncle Silas of something, and as he stood up in the bath and she began toweling his back, he said to me,
I recollect now what I were going to tell you. Or having a swim with a lot of chaps once in the mill, Brook, at...
"We don't want to hear your old tales either. We've heard them all times anew."
"Ah, not this one."
Nevertheless, her words silenced him. He stood there dumb, almost meek, all the time she was toweling him dry. And it was only when she vanished into the kitchen to fetch a second towel for him to dry his toes that he recollected the story he'd been trying to tell me and came to life.
"I was swimming with these chaps in the mill brook, and we'd left all our clothes on the bank.
Mind yourselves!"
The housekeeper had returned with the towel, and my Uncle Silas, as though he'd never even heard of the tale he was so anxious to tell, and I was so anxious to hear, said,
"Next year I'll have peas where I'd taters, and taters where I'd carrots."
"Dry your toes."
"Oh, dry myself and don't talk so much."
At the same moment, she thrust the towel in his hand, and then began to scoop the water out of the bath with an enamel basin and put it into a bucket. When the bucket was full, she hastened out of the room with it, her half-laced shoes slopping noisily in her haste. Almost before she'd gone through the door, and long before we heard the splash of water in the sink, my Uncle Silas said swiftly,
"Tot out!"
And I uncorked the wine bottle while he found the glasses in the little cupboard above the fire. We were standing there drinking the wine, so red and rich and soft, Silas in nothing but his shirt. And going on with the story, he had reached the point when the men, coming out of the millstream, had found their clothes gone, when the housekeeper returned.
"I think I slept peas alongside the wood," he said serenely, while she refilled the bucket, "and perhaps back of the well."
"You get your toes dried and get dressed."
"Oh, mind your own business and get supper, and look slippy."
As soon as she'd left the room again, he resumed the tale. But no sooner had he begun than she returned, and it went on like this, he telling a sentence of the tale, and she returning, and he interspersing some angelic and airy remark about his peas and potatoes, until at last she came in to spread the cloth on the table and lay the supper. She was in the room for so long, laying out the plates and the cutlery, that at last he gave it up, turning to me with an air of satanic innocence, to say,
"Oh, I'll tell you the name of that tater when I can think on it. My memory ain't as good as it were."
After that he proceeded meekly to put on his pants, tucking in the voluminous folds of his shirt before tying up the tapes. While the tail of his shirt was still hanging loose, he remembered the potatoes I had put in the hot ashes under the fire, and seizing the toasting fork, he began to prod their skins.
"Damn it! They'll be done afore I get me trousers on," he said.
And standing there, with the toasting fork in his hand, his pants tight against his legs and the tail of his shirt protruding, he looked more than anything else like the devil of tradition prodding the roasting sinners. The veritable air of devilishness was still about him when, finding a moment later that the housekeeper had left the room again, he turned swiftly to me to say,
"Give us another mouthful of wine, and I'll tell you what happened. Some gals had got the clothes. They stood upon the bridge and dangled their trousers over and threatened to drop them in the bill pond. Well, what do you think of that? There we were, swimming about with nothing on, and they wouldn't give us the clothes.
He went on to tell me how gradually they grew tired and desperate, and at last angry at the three girls dangling over the bridge, while they grew colder and colder in the deep mill pond, and how finally he himself climbed out of the water and ran up to the bridge stark naked and frightened the girls into dropping the clothes and retreating. Long before he'd finished, I noticed that the housekeeper had returned and was standing in the doorway, unseen by my Uncle Silas, attentively listening.
God almighty, you should have seen them drop the clothes and run when they seen me. All except one.
What did she do?
Run off across the meadow with me clothes under her arms. What do you think of that?
Well, what did you do?
Run after her.
A strange, almost soft expression of reminiscence came over his face, flushed with the bath and the wine, as though he could clearly see the river, the meadow, and he himself running across the summer grass, naked, pursuing the girl running away with his clothes.
Roman, he said at last. I never did find out who she were. Never did find out.
At that moment, the housekeeper came in from the doorway, moving so quietly for once that he scarcely heard her, the sound of the cheese dish being laid on the table startling him so much that he could only turn and stare at her, fingering the tapes of his pants and at a loss for words.
Didn't you ever find out?
She said.
No, I was just telling the boy. It's been so damn long ago.
She looked at him for a moment and then said,
I know who she were, and so do you.
It was the only time I ever saw him at a loss for an answer, and it was almost the only time I ever saw her smile. He stood there, slowly licking his lips, in uneasy silence, until at last she snapped at him with all the old habitual tartness.
Get yourself dressed, man. I ain't running away with your clothes now, even if I did then.
She began to help him on with his clothes. He still had nothing to say. But once, as she was fastening the back buttons of his trousers, and he stood with his face turned away from her, he gave me a smiling but inscrutable look, rich with devilry, his eyelids lowered and his lips shining wet with wine. And I began to understand then something I'd not understood before.